Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 12th, 2005. This session, God and Smokey Bear, Fire as the Enemy, presented by Gene Larson in the Fireside Room, disc number LAJ-2005-01. Let's listen in.
Will you just go around and say names and where you're from to start with?
That would be fun. I'm Larry. Originally from Ohio, and I've been here a month, so good to hear you.
I'm Janet, I'm from Seattle, currently though working at the B&B in Chelan.
I'm Hans, and I'm from Minnesota, in the St. Paul area, but most recently spent a year on Whidbey Island, out near Seattle.
I'm Jan, and I'm from Walla Walla, Washington.
Mm-hmm. I'm Marie, and I'm from Walla Walla, Washington.
Jeanette
from
Duluth, Minnesota, and I'm here for 3 weeks in the dining room.
I'm Rita, and I'm impersonating Gene's significant other from this little spot in time.
I'm Pete from the Twin Cities.
And I'm Ray from Lorain, Ohio, now living in Wenatchee, Washington.
Thanks for coming, everyone. What I want to start with is, Psalm 104, which is a great creation song. Do any of you know Psalm 104? It is just a terrific, wonderful, thrilling psalm, and we'll get more into that tomorrow. But by way of having our focus and center a bit, listen to this. Praise the Lord, O my soul. O Lord, my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty. You wrap yourself in light as with a garment. You stretch out the heavens like a tent and lay the beams of the upper chambers on their waters. You make the clouds your chariot and ride on the wings of the wind. You make the wind your messenger and flames of fire your servants. Oh God, thank you for wildfire. And bless all who fight it. Keep them in safety. And help us to love it. In Jesus' name, amen. That last part of it might be a stretch, even for me, help us to love fire. But let me tell you how I got fascinated by wildfire. It was 2003 in Missoula, and it was a really hot, dry year, and there had been a few fires down the Bitterroot Valley earlier. But one day in August, we got a call from my stepson, who was delivering Chinese food, Missoula, and it was late, it was like about 8 o'clock at night. And he said, you guys have to go over to the Higgins Avenue Bridge and check this out. Blue Mountain is on fire, and you can see the flames from the bridge. Now, the Higgins Avenue Bridge is right downtown. It's the main downtown bridge over the Clark Fork River. We live a couple blocks away, so we went over there. Danny and I looked over towards Blue Mountain, and sure enough, here was flames. This is about probably 8 miles west of us. And right around the forehead of Blue Mountain, there were flames. It was starting to get dark. It was so cool. You know how it is when you're looking. So cool. Well, the next day, you couldn't see the flames because the smoke had gotten so bad. This fire was growing and growing. And there were other fires around Missoula, not close in and not terribly dangerous to the community, but they were all producing smoke. So pretty soon, a few weeks into this thing, you could not see any of the mountains west of town. You could barely see the outline of Mount Sentinel, which is really close, really close. And the smoke was awful. You'd wake up in the morning with headaches. And my son had started football practice. They had to do football practice inside. Kids had to play inside. Old people had to stay inside. It was really awful. It was really awful. And it was really less scary than just a real pain. But then I started listening to how we were praying about the wildfire in church. And it was always sort of around a theme of, oh God, put out the fire. Oh God, protect the firefighters. We have firefighters coming in from all over the country. Protect the firefighters. They were really working to help save some really nice homes, mostly. I had a friend, actually, who has this lovely home up O'Brien Creek, and they were trying to keep these lovely homes from being burnt down. This is sort of an issue in wildfire ethics, people building on the wildland-urban interface. And over the course of this fire, two homes actually did burn down, but they were up on the top of the mountain and were fancy schmancy ones. No one lost their life. But the fire prayers were fascinating to me. Oh God, put out the fires. Protect the firefighters. Send rain. And I understand that, because I really wanted those to be out too, but I knew, as do most of you, as most everybody does now, that fires are really essential to the health of the forest. And so if God would really answer the prayers we were praying, the forests would be more of a mess than they are now. And if God put out the fires and suppressed all wildfire, we'd really be in trouble. So here's a theological conundrum. What were we going to do with that? Then one day, Daniel, my husband, was blessing the food, and sort of, we always sort of go beyond just the food. And he just said, oh God, thank you for these fires. He prayed that without any nuance at all. And we talked about it, and I said, you know, I wish I could pray that. Just this flat out, thank you for the fires. But I couldn't. I didn't have it in me quite to do that. But I sort of wanted to. So that whole little bit of prayerful wrestling got me thinking about wildfire and this theological disjunctive thing. The old paradigm that you all know, I imagine, is that fire is the enemy, and fire should be suppressed at all costs, all the time. We are God's little helpers in fighting every fire. And sometimes it went beyond that. Fire is evil. You know, and if you think about some of the imagery in Scripture about fire, especially apocalyptic fire and hellfire, you know, I think sometimes those images go into the mix and add to the fight. But now we have this new paradigm that fire is, I don't know if I want to say fire is our friend, but in a way that's true, biologically. Fire is a friend of the forest. It brings new life to the forest, and in a sense, people need to get out of the way. Now, the question that's behind all my presentations is, what's the theological paradigm? When I was going through seminary in the late 70s, when we talked about creation, it was always in terms of, well, in order to do creation, God had to restrain chaos or defeat chaos, have mastery over chaos. So creation was always put in those sorts of terms, which seems to line up sort of with this, you suppress chaos, you suppress wildfire. Wildfire is chaotic. It's to me, in my head at least, those things go together pretty well. And tomorrow we're going to get into Genesis and look and see if that really is the paradigm there. In fact, we're going to see that there's all sorts of different variations on that. And that's not the only one. But I still hear colleagues talking about that. That creation is defined in terms of putting chaos in its boundaries. But that's not how it works biologically, right? Mm-hmm. So my question is, what's the new theological paradigm? Is there a way that we can understand biblically and maybe in other ways, new ways of understanding chaos? And using wildfire as sort of a case study. So that's where we're going. Today we're going to look at sort of the cultural history of why we came to see fire as the enemy. Tomorrow we'll look at Genesis 1 and 2 and some other biblical texts. Wednesday we'll return to the fire ecology question, looking at the fires of Yellowstone in 1988 and how that paradigm shifted of fighting fire and then understanding fire to be useful. Thursday we'll go back to the theological side and push on into areas that I'm a little bit unqualified to talk about. Chaos theory, new thoughts about creation, how some systematic theologians are talking about God as creator, it's sort of wild. And by then I hope we'll all be fired up for it, so to speak. Friday is going to be a day that I hope we can construct together. I know that not all of you are going to be around by Friday, but my hope is that through the week we'll start thinking about wildfire in new ways. And I really invite you to use Holden's resources and your own resources to come up with something creative. What are the faith practices that we might start observing as Christians that would put us more in sync with this new understanding of fire, and I want to say this new understanding of creation? What are you inspired to create as you think about wildfire? St. Francis of Assisi talked about weather fire, in his great hymn to creation. So I just today want to invite you to carry these reflections into your creative side. Poems, pots, weavings, songs, prayers, justice ideas. I mean, where might this lead us? And then I'm going to have a sign-up sheet I'll get up by tomorrow. If you have something you want to present, we'll just do that on Friday. We'll be sort of bringing stuff into how we might worship with these things. I've got some stuff to share with you. But I really hope that you have some stuff to share too, or else we'll have a really short session. I really want to do this conversationally. If you have a question or comment as I'm going, please just interrupt and we'll have a conversation. For sure, I hope we learn from each other. I'm not a fire ecologist. I'm not a scientist. My sons laugh at me when they hear that I'm doing this stuff. Do we have any fire ecologists or foresters among us?
I have three sons.
Oh, right. So you know the stuff.
Well, I should say I have a son-in-law and my daughter and a son who teaches forestry.
Oh, great.
And economics.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Anybody here a former firefighter? Okay. Have any of you experienced wildland fire up close and personal? So you know what that's about. Now, last summer, the village had to get evacuated because of that. Have any of you suffered from any other sort of natural catastrophe? Experiencing the chaos of nature really overwhelming?
Earthquake when I was a kid. I lived down in Southern California.
Yeah, so in some ways, let's keep all that stuff in the back of our minds. Earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes. Katrina is so much in our hearts and minds. Sort of in the same ballpark here. And who loves to watch fire? Any pyromaniacs here play with fire? There is an undoubted fascination with fire. It is primordial. And I want to lift that up and acknowledge it. I think that's part of what's going on in this primordial fire. And I think what's going on with the struggles we've had over the last century is this notion that human beings can somehow control nature. This great hubris that we've said we can control nature. We're going to talk about that throughout the week, but here's a great quote to start off with. John McPhee wrote The Control of Nature, which is an interesting title in itself, but he was inspired to write this book when he was on campus at the University of Wyoming, walked by the engineering school, and saw this motto in the stone in the engineering school. Strive on. The control of nature is won, not given. So, there you go, strive on. We've been striving for quite a while. Okay, so that's sort of my story of how I got started. I want to do Smokey's story. I've got some slides of old Smokey Bear posters and other memorabilia that tell the cultural story of how we came to see fire as such a bugger. And I love this because I grew up with Smokey. I mean, there's a great Smokey website. Just do smokeybear.org or com and you'll get all this stuff. And it was really, really fun. But I look over the trajectory of Smokey, and he is now 61 years old. his heyday was in my youth. And so I know and love Smokey. And there he is. There's our guy. Prevent forest fires, that's sort of shorthand for the motto I know best, which is only you can prevent forest fires, right? So, go Smokey. Now, I'm sort of a novice with this thing, and it's got a really touchy touch, so I'm going to try to do this so I don't advance it twice. Oh, there's Smokey. In fact, this is Smokey right down at Lucerne. If you make a little turn in the corner, there he is.
Heavy traffic. That's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's where it is.
Yeah. Only for those hours or that hour and a half.
Yeah. Zoom up and down. So, yeah, Smokey's everywhere. He gets around. It's pretty good for being as old as he is. Oh, darn. Okay, this is my first thing. Now, I know how to do this, but this might take me a while to go backwards. Okay, no, wait, I gotta do this. And I gotta look this way and make. Oh, there we go. Okay, this is the very first Smokey the Bear poster. 1944, the year of his birth. He was a big cub. The United States Forest Service put him to work during the war with the help of the Wartime Advertising Council. But Smokey wasn't their first effort.
Look at this. Ruthless shimmies.
Yeah, this is pretty amazing. In the spring of 1942, a Japanese submarine shelled an oil field near Santa Barbara, California. This really raised fears in the War Department about the vulnerability of the West Coast to out-of-control wildfires, either due to enemy action or due to all the firefighting age young men off fighting the war. So their concern was pretty well placed, really. The British Royal Air Force had set German forests on fire earlier as an act of war. So they really wanted people on the West Coast especially to be very cautious in the woods and very mindful. But look at that image. Isn't that just a scary thing? Here's another one. Careless matches aid the Axis. This link between firefighting and warfighting was made in this 1944 poster. And really, fire here itself starts becoming the enemy. But this theme of fire as enemy really predated the war. Here's a really cool slide. Poster from 1940. 1939 was a really bad fire year in the Northwest. Tillamook, Oregon fire burned 300,000 acres, 3,000 men on the lines, 10 million board feet of timber destroyed. Sawmills put out of business. 1939, Great Depression. I mean, it was a bad deal. Fire here is an apocalyptic agent of death. I mean, to me, this reminds me of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, right? And note, it's man's carelessness that is the bad guy. Well, but we didn't just stick with these apocalyptic scary images. Walt Disney provided another angle. Bambi, the movie, came out in 1944. To great popular acclaim. The fire scene in the movie, have all of you seen Bambi? Mm-hmm. You know the fire scene, which is really scary? That wasn't in the book. The book, the problem was
pictures. Say at the top. What's that top part say?
You know, I was hoping that when we got it up, I really can't even read it from here. Something, Bambi.
Bambi's mother?
Huh? You know, I'm sorry, the quality of that is so... Okay. Something's
not
that's
Bambi.
Anyway, that's Bambi. And in the book, poachers were the problem, not horse fires. But in the movie, of course, it was the forest fire. One writer on fire, he said that Bambi is the single most dangerous movie ever produced for a clear understanding about the nature of forest fires. Because it just makes it so emotional, right? The Forest Service asked to use the Bambi image. And Walt Disney says, okay, you can do it for a year. But Walt knew that there was a lot of money to be made in franchising even back then. So they had Bambi for a year, but then they needed another image. And they found that the sweet image of Bambi was very popular. So they started looking for another animal to carry the message. So enter Smokey. By 1952, he was a star, making the cover of Newsweek. I was born in 1952. He became even more popular because a real Smokey Bear had been found. Mm-hmm. This is the comic book, the true story of Smokey Bear. In 1950, a little black bear cub was rescued from the huge El Capitan fire in New Mexico. And the Forest Service adopted him as the real Smokey Bear. They patched him up and sent him to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. And I think I had this comic book. Or one version of it. Here's the real Smokey. I like the cartoon guy better. There's our guy. He died, and then another Smokey was found, and I'm not sure if there's still Smokey Bear at the National Zoo. That would be interesting. Does anybody know? So there's one more aspect of Smokey's story, though, that is utterly fascinating, and this is Smokey at prayer. This stamp is from 1944. So here, Smokey and the Forest Service is enlisting faith in, and a real sense of the Creator to fight forest fires. It keeps going. God wanted the forests to be free from fire, and Smokey was his messenger. These are from 1944. Thou shalt not destroy thy forests. And Smokey's commandments, break matches, crush smokes, be sure all fires are out. And look at this one. This is amazing. Notice the cross in the background. Smokey now has become a Christian. The others were, you know, sort of Judeo-Christian. But definitely we've got this sense of Golgotha almost. And whatever those... Well, those are two bears, I think, actually, but on either side of the cross, although it's a little hard to see. Obviously, you've got a real smoky, red, fiery background there.
Looks like that's a grave.
That's what I was thinking. It's a grave marker. Oh, the cross is a grave marker.
There you go.
That's kill animals.
Yeah, yeah. Not as much as you think, but yeah, or people. Yeah, that is a grave. You're right. So there is Smokey in a very plaintive prayer place. We'll keep that slide up for a little bit. This is from 1953. The war was over by now. The advertising was not. In one of Smokey's radio shows, he had radio shows in the 1950s, Roy Rogers comes on and urges people to be vigilant against fire because to do otherwise is sinful. These explicitly religious language of this stuff. Smokey Bear is the longest running public information campaign in the history of the United States. When I was a little kid, remember only you can prevent forest fires was absolutely drilled into my head, and I was a really true believer. I loved smoking. Never mind that it was false. You know, very often we can't prevent forest fires. Lightning causes a lot of them, although a lot of them still are caused by human carelessness, and Smokey's campaign continues on that idea. But besides lightning, we've got drought, variations in humidity, global warming has been implicated in these recent Northwest fires. My local newspaper, the Missoulian, just had a really cool article on all the funny ways that forest fires can be started, and this was my very favorite. A flaming fish was found by firefighters under a power line, so they reconstructed how this happened, and it was all burnt out around there. It started a fire.
seems that an osprey had a fish in its mouth, dropped it on the power line. The fish bursts into flames, falls to the ground, and starts a fire. So there you go.
You're probably
not quite only.
So I've read that about squirrels too.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, they had a whole list of funny ways that forest fires start.
Actually, we did have a fire in Walla Walla from a squirrel frying on the lines.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's pretty funny.
As I started looking into fire history, I was really amazed to learn that this motto, you know, all fires need to be out, do everything you can to prevent them, and then if you can't prevent them, do everything you can to put them out. This is a relatively recent understanding. The 19th century had a very, very different understanding about wildfire. The Native Americans used fire as a tool. They set fires for hunting. They would clear out the underbrush, fertilize the soil so you'd get some really lush grasses grow up, attract the deer, and open up the vistas in the forest for good shooting and good travel. They also used fire to flush out game from the forest, and they used it to fight enemies. In the Lewis and Clark journals from 1804, that we're celebrating this bicentennial right now, Lewis reported this. Every spring the plains are set on fire, and the buffalo are tempted to cross the river in search of the fresh grass, which immediately succeeds the burning. And then he goes on to explain that sometimes in trying to cross the river, the bison would get stuck on an ice floe, early enough in the spring, float down the river on this ice floe, and into the trap set by other Indian hunters downstream. Really, use some fire and ice together. Early on, white settlers also made use of fire. California timbermen in the 1880s used the practice of light burning, prescribed burns, to make their sequoia forests healthy. Sequoia are a species of tree that's fire dependent. They did it to reduce fuels and avoid big catastrophic fires, the same way now that they're using it these days. A boundary survey report in 1904 said this: the white man has come to think that fire is a part of the forest, and a beneficial part of that. All classes share in this view, and all set fires, sheepmen and cattlemen on the open range, miners, lumbermen, ranchmen, sportsmen, and campers. And he was appalled. But that was sort of the culture then. But at the same time then, there started growing up in the early part of the 20th century, this, we've got to fight fire tooth and nail. They were saying that the only responsible thing to do would be to fight all wildfires, because timber was an asset that was needed by the nation to build this growing westward civilization. And yet in 1910 in Sunset magazine, this is the same Sunset we know today that talk about patios and, you know, how to fry up a good trout. But a timberman in California wrote an article in 1910 urging that light burning not only be acceptable, but made mandatory, and stated that those who refused to burn were being irresponsible. So, okay, get that, 1910. Fires, of course, were fought when they threatened structures, and fires on the prairie were catastrophic because they just zoomed along. But there wasn't that attitude towards wildfire as enemy. How did it come to be our enemy? When did we start fighting fire in principle? When did we start believing that fire degraded the land and the forest? When people already knew that it really helped the forest. Several things started happening. Settlement, principally. I mean, fire had always burned in the forest, but people weren't there. So when people and towns got to be there, fire was a problem. Western forests are really different from eastern forests. Western forests, for the most part, except on the west coast, are drier and subject to periodic big fires. Whereas in the east coast forests have been logged since forever. and they're wetter, and so they don't burn in the same way. And they didn't really understand how Western forests burn. Yellowstone National Park plays in this story in several spots. Yellowstone was established in 1872 by U.S. Grant as a pleasuring ground for the enjoyment of the people. But the park suffered early on from vandals and poachers. Because again, I mean, think of this, 1872, there weren't a whole lot of people out there. So in 1886, the Department of Interior asked the Army to take over the administration of the park, and they did. Fire suppression was number one on their list because what the poachers would do would set the park on fire to drive the game out so that they could shoot them. And if you've ever been to Yellowstone, especially in the northern part, there are 10 bazillion elk there. So fire suppression was a big deal, and catching the poachers was a big deal. They were pretty lucky early on, the Army was, in terms of fire suppression. They didn't have any roads, they didn't have very much equipment. One sergeant put out a fire with his bare hands. Fires had been allowed to burn naturally, obviously, in Yellowstone Park until then, and so there wasn't a big fire or fuel buildup. In 1888, 100 fires burned in the park, and they burned a total of 5 acres. In 1889, there were fewer fires, about 70 fires, but they burned a lot more acres, probably because of weather and conditions of moisture and stuff. So what was the conclusion of the Army after this? They said, uh-oh, this year almost got away from us. What should we do? Should we say, oh my goodness, the fire has its own logic and human beings need to sort of let it burn a little bit? I mean, there are no structures in the park at this time, right? Or few. But they took, they anticipated Tim the Toolman in Home Improvement, and they said, we need more power. And so they got more power. They got better equipment, they built roads, they established campgrounds to keep people in defined places so that they could keep track of wildfire. And they did a pretty good job of it. Commercial value of timber for the expanding nation was really important. Teddy Roosevelt established the Forest Service in 1905 in the Department of Agriculture, not Interior, Agriculture, because it was a crop. Trees were crops. The mission of the Forest Service was to manage forests for healthy timber production and their watersheds for clean and abundant water. Fire suppression was primary. Burned trees were wasted trees. Gifford Pinchot was the first director of the Forest Service, and he knew the benefits of light fire, the benefits of prescribed burning. But he was trained in Europe because at that time the United States didn't have any forest study department in any of the universities. And European forests are really different from American forests. I mean, sort of the East Coast times 10. Dense settlement, wetter conditions, highly managed forests. Skewed in the context of the American West. So Gifford Pinchot comes out and says, we've got to really highly manage these forests and suppress all fire. He called wildfire the dragon devastation, which is really interesting, I think. Because when we get to the biblical stuff, one of the ways that chaos was personified was as this sea monster, Leviathan. And you can think of monsters in the same monstrous family, this dragon, chaos. And what do you do with dragons? I mean, if you think mythologically, you want to get rid of that dragon, or he's going to eat you, burn you up. So, the dragon devastation. Everything changed in 1910. 1905, the Forest Service was born. 1910, huge fires in the Northwest. They call it the big blow-up. It was a very hot, dry year in the Montana-Idaho border. The fire season started early and went late. They would get firefighters by going to the bars in Butte and Wallace, Idaho, and getting guys out of the bars.
I started with you by breathing
out. Yeah. And on August How is 20th? This fire blew up. On August 20th, the firestorm blew up, and they had never experienced a firestorm before. They'd never really encountered these conditions before. Firestorms produce their own weather. The wind comes in often, a cold front comes in, and just kicks it up. And there's so much an increase in the heat of the fire that it produces its own weather. The smoke and ash really put out the sun. In Denver, this is what, 800 miles away, in Denver, the temperature dropped 19 degrees in 10 minutes because of the ash obscuring the sun. A 42-mile-an-hour wind carried smoke into Denver from the Montana-Idaho border, 800 miles away. The firestorm lasted 2 days. It was put out by rain and snow. It burned 3 million acres the size of Connecticut, 8 billion board feet of timber. Killed 78 men, destroyed the Montana towns of Haugen, Taft, Henderson, and DeBorgia. You can see, sort of go there still off Interstate 90. Destroyed 1/3 of Wallace, Idaho. Here's some pictures. The windstorm blew these trees down before the fire came. The windstorm that was in advance of the fire. This is Wallace, Idaho, after the fire.
What year is this?
1910. These are two survivors. And this is the great hero of the 1910 fires, Ed Pulaski. He was a U.S. Forest Service guy, and he took his firefighters, and when he realized that there was no way they were going to outrun or get this fire put out, he headed for a mine shaft, and he got all of these guys in the mine shaft, and it was horrible because the fire blew over the mine shaft. It was terrifying. He had a pistol, and at one point he stood in the mouth of the mine shaft and said, "If anybody tries to get out of here, I'm going to shoot you," because they wanted to. The noise was horrible. It was terrifying. But he kept him in there, and he saved all but one. Some guys passed out because of the lack of oxygen. The guy who died probably drowned in the water after he passed out. There's water in the mine shaft. But he was the great fire hero of 1910. Later on, he invented a tool to fight fires with. On one side, it is a hoe, and on the other side, it's an axe, and it's called a Pulaski. Every firefighter carries a Pulaski to this day. It's the same thing. So here we have this huge, huge conflagration within a few years of the start of Forest Service. And again, what was their response? Were they going to reevaluate their mission? Were they going to say, "My gosh, we don't know squat about forest fires"? No. Tim the Toolman, war power. This is when the progressive movement in American history was starting to really roll. They really believed that human beings have a lot of power to affect change and to make the world better. And I want to say the same thing. The Forest Service asked for and got more men, more training, more equipment, a much bigger budget. Budgets just kept ballooning, ballooning, ballooning. 1910 is called the Valley Forge of the U.S. Forest Service. It really changed everything. Up to that time, there was debate about, you know, prescribed burning. These guys in California kept saying, "Gosh, no, this is wrong-headed. We know that fire is healthy for the forest. It keeps these sequoia groves alive. It actually protects the great big mother sequoia trees." And there was, you know, this guy's article in Sunset Magazine came out 1 month before the big blow-up of 1910. So that whole discussion about prescribed burning was squelched by this disaster. Now we know that the 1910 fire was a typical 100-year fire. Different forests burn in different ways, and these forests tend to burn catastrophically anyway. It's stand replacement fires. It was a typical 100-year fire. The forest was just ready for a good fire, and it got it. The difference, of course, is that people had settled there since the last one. One more thing really was a huge boost to the growth of firefighting and this whole mentality, that we can control nature. William James is an American philosopher and pacifist of that era. In 1910, in that same year, it's a big year, he gave a speech and he later turned it into a pamphlet, a speech called The Moral Equivalent of War. I had no idea that it went way back to William James in 1910. I associated it with Jimmy Carter, right? And didn't he use it with the gas crisis? Oil crisis? I think he did. Anyway, here's William James' argument, and I'll get this slide up so you can read it. Here's the central part of it. 1910, he was remembering the slaughter of the Civil War. He was reflecting on the martial spirit in man that he found to be a positive for our culture. The martial spirit and war and army life helped young men shape their character along the ideas of sacrifice, being willing to sacrifice for the greater good, willing to build community. It developed a manly hardiness. So James' question was, what else besides war can produce this character building in our young men? And this is what he had to say about it. This was a really popular pamphlet. James's solution, conscript youth in an army enlisted against nature. Again, that mentality against nature. Firefighting was never mentioned in this essay, in the speech. But it did become the moral equivalent of war, because firefighting was organized in the Forest Service along a military model. They used warfighting models of organization and training, and then fire did become the enemy. And remained the enemy for most of the 20th century. Are you mostly done reading that slide? There's one more slide I want to show you. This model actually was pretty successful. And it sort of fed in to our human hubris. We really thought we could succeed at fighting fire in the forest. And you can see these comparisons here. 1910, the big blow-up, 3-month fire season, 4,000 firefighters not trained, 3 million acres burned, 78 men died. 1934, Selway fire, Selway, Bitterroot, Wilderness, Idaho, Montana. Bad fire season, 5,000 firefighters, much better trained, 300,000 acres burned, and I didn't read of anybody who died. As a result of the Selway fires, the chief of the Forest Service at that time, a guy named Silcox, said that we're going to put out all fires by 10 o'clock the next morning. And the idea made a little bit of sense. At nighttime, the fires go down. I mean, it's cooler, humidity goes up. And if you get on a fire right away and get it while it's little, you don't have to fight it when it's big. But that was the law in the Forest Service. And if it wasn't out by 10 o'clock one morning, it better well be out by 10 o'clock the next morning. So you put massive amounts of manpower, at this time it was all manpower, on the fire line in order to do that. 1940s, post-war, got another tool in firefighting with the smoke jumpers. A lot of these guys had been paratroopers in World War II, and they landed these guys on little tiny fires to put them out by 10 in the morning. You guys know the book Young Men in Fire by Norman McLean? Anybody read that? It's a passionate book. It's a beautiful tragedy book. 1949, Man Gulch is just outside of Helena, Montana. A little fire started. 15 smoke jumpers flew out of Missoula, landed in there. They were heading over to do the fire. Another wind shifted, blew the fire up, chased these guys up this 45-degree angle slope, and all but three died. They just could not outrun the fire. It was the first great tragedy of the smoke jumpers. Forest Service philosophy, you know, kept along the same lines. 1967, Sundance Fire, and there's a bunch of cluster fires. That was a bad year. 2 month fire season, 13,000 firefighters on the line, 90,000 acres burned, 3 men died. But if you compare especially 1910 and 1967, that looks like success. That we could effectively marshal the troops against wildland fire. Smokey the Bear was doing his job. Most Americans were true believers. But the Forest Service was starting to conclude in the 60s and even before that fighting every fire was a mistake. There were lots of forestry schools in the States by then. They were learning the science of silviculture. The beginnings of policy change were happening in the 60s in the Forest Service. And they decided to start allowing natural fires to burn in out-of-the-way stands where they wouldn't destroy any buildings or structures or make any people too nervous. The public didn't really get introduced to this change in policy and philosophy, I don't think, until 1988 with the Yellowstone fires. But it was in place before then. We'll visit Yellowstone again on Wednesday. Tomorrow we will look at Scripture, Genesis 1 and 2. We'll look at the Psalms. We'll look at Isaiah. We'll talk about creation monsters and battles to the beginning of creation and Babylon and all sorts of really fun things. So, but there you go. Comments, questions? Hopefully we have about 10 minutes if you want to have any conversation.
My dad was in the CCC, I think it was in the late 30s, early 40s, up in this area somewhere. And I guess their, you know, their job was to build some bridges. I think what I remember him saying, forest fires, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they did pretty much everything in the forest. In Missoula during the war years, conscientious objectors served as forest firefighters.
I'm really interested in how this applies to the whole hurricane situation. How we try and control and keep the waters back. You know, I heard somewhere that the levees were built to withstand a class 3 hurricane. You know, and they knew that one day a 5 or a 4 would be coming. I'm interested in how this applies to that.
There's been some interesting stuff out on that. Have any of you come across it, sort of the impacts of the levees on the Delta? That by building the levees,
the ground is sinking.
Well, yeah, the ground is sinking. I mean, New Orleans is lower than it didn't used
because
to be.
Because it used to have water in there, because it used to flood and to kind of just keep it fluffy.
Right.
It was marsh.
Yeah. It was marsh, right. And now it's just sinking because it's solid and dropping. Yeah. Lower.
And by building the levees, the Mississippi just goes sort of shooting there, and so the silt is deposited out at the mouth of the river rather than allowing the silt to get in where the city is and keeping it above sea level. So it is really ironic, the stuff we build in our illusion that we can control these elemental forces of nature. Apparently work. I mean, that's the thing. They apparently work for a while. And then,
I bet you on the levees, they were kind of betting on the come line, so to speak. That's from too many years of living in Reno. But they didn't want to put the money out to build a levee that would come maybe only once every 100 years, like a level 5, you know, or 4. So they went for the middle ground and got the thing that would happen most often. That's one of the theories that I have heard. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, that sounds like politics.
There's a lot of politics in this one.
Yes.
Heard that, you know, the Corps of Engineers, or I don't know if it's the U.S. Corps of Engineers, but the people working in New Orleans had set up some plans for really improving the levees,
and they didn't get it funded.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 1990, my husband and I had occasion to come in from West Yellowstone, and we've been vacationing in that area, Ennis, Montana. Stayed in West Yellowstone and came in that entrance that first afternoon and kind of did a quick tour in the afternoon, and was a fire, that's where the fire was. And it was quite a discussion, even though we lived in Nevada, and there was a big thing up there, down there, and to look at all of this forest down and all that, and popping up is the fireweed. I had to get a book. I'm a wildflower person, and I did not know what fireweed was. And I bought one at the store in Yellowstone because I want to know what that beautiful pink flower was. And apparently, it's one of those things that rises first out of the ashes. And it was really beautiful. It seems to have done fine now, doesn't it? You know, the forest is doing well, where there's a contribution.
Glacier Park has a sign by one of the hills that says the 1920-something fire, and it still is very, you know, the dead trees standing up in it. And the story that I heard, which is probably just rumor, was that it was set by unemployed people who like to get a job fighting fires. So.
That happened in Nevada just a few years ago.
Yeah, and firefighting pays pretty well. Mm-hmm. And that's happened more than once.
You mentioned global warming as the cause of forest fires. Sources does that come from?
There was a 1994 article in Nature magazine. I think it's the November 94 issue. Someone was studying the pattern of burns in the Northwest, this forest, not the wet coastal forest, but the Northwest. And they looked at, even examined in big old trees, the pattern of the rings will show you a fire here. I mean, they can read that. And this one researcher said that it really looks like it could be an early sign that global warming is accelerating the drying process of the forest. It wasn't, anything in global warming is not bells and whistles, but they could see by the growth rings in the tree that the rate of the drought and the drying out process was really accelerated over the previous 100 years in these tree ring studies they were doing.
So like the 1910 fire there would have been prior to most internal combustion engines.
Right.
And if you look at history prior to that, you know, there were times very similar to the times now where fires and drought and all that were closer together. Mm-hmm. Way before the internal combustion engine. So, mm-hmm.
That's true.
You could build a case either way.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think when you add up the other global warming data, I think it's a cumulative argument rather than just a distinct one. But for sure, there were catastrophic wildfires well before internal combustion engines. And, you know, the point about this 1910 fire was that type of forest, I mean, different types of forest, different trees tend to burn at different intervals. So some forests burn, like Yellowstone Forest, part of it tended to burn, you know, every 7 to 15 years. Back in the old days, natural fire. They just have a sort of a cool fire come through and clean out the brush, and most of the trees would be fine and would hopscotch along. And we'll talk about this a little bit more on Wednesday. But some types of trees that's the type of fire they have. That's the type of fire they nurture because that's how they propagate. So big blow up hot fire, totally natural.
For some trees, isn't it that the fire is what will set the cones open, the cones and propagate.
Yeah. Right, ponderosa pine.
Yeah.
I think what the gentleman was trying to say is that, you know, with the global warming, there might be one man who comes up with a theory of that, and there might be somebody else who said that's a lot of baloney.
I understand that. It's not conclusive. I mean,
right, exactly.
Obviously, there's not the sense of, oh my gosh, it's global warming. Rita and I were talking about this the other day, and it's sort of like, well, maybe it's not. But the other data on global warming says it's coming. I mean, there are these data that you've got now from satellites and stuff like that. So maybe it makes sense now to really, really start decreasing our production of greenhouse gases and stuff, which are bound to make it worse.
Yeah, but I kind of feel like if we didn't create all this, we can't destroy it.
You're an optimist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a great American Indian saying, or at least attributed to American Indians, that of course we can't destroy the earth, and we don't need really to worry about the earth, because the earth will recreate itself. It's us that we could cause to be extinct, because we could create conditions we can't live in and survive in anymore. And it's pretty clear we're able to do that with nuclear warfare, if nothing else. And so there's that hope against horror, I guess, that, yeah, we probably aren't, let's hope, able to destroy creation, but we can make life a lot more miserable for ourselves on the planet, or actually cause our species to live miserably or not at all by choices we make on how we clean things up and use things. So the saying was something like, yeah, the earth has a million bazillion years to regenerate herself, but humans need a certain kind of environment, and we need to pay attention to that.
I could say maybe for this valley, there is conclusive evidence that the glaciers are not reducing significantly, and therefore all the water for this whole valley, and therefore Lake Chelan, and therefore the Columbia Waterway, I mean, that's all impacted by this. And the glaciers are reducing due to rising temperatures and to less rainfall and precipitation in general throughout the year. And that will all lead to, I mean, more fires for this specific particular valley. I know, so that plays one role as well.
Yeah, but hundreds of years, thousands of years ago, there was massive glaciers. We had an ice age. And I just kind of feel we're going through a, you know, we're just here for a short time, 100 years, and then we pass on, next generation comes on. This earth has been around for millions, billions, whatever. And, you know, we just see a little short piece of time in there. You know, so we can't go back, you know, 20 years and say, okay, 20 years ago it was like this, and now it's like this. We're going straight that we, it might take hundreds of years for a change in the whole structure of the world. You know, it's, I don't know. Yeah, maybe I'm just an optimist, but I just don't think we can possibly do anything to destroy anything. I just figure it's a change in nature.
I think if we destroy, for example, the ozone layer, which is something we cannot create or recreate, then that's something which is truly dangerous for the future of species, for the future of Earth at large. There are some things that we really can destroy now that perhaps could not have been destroyed before.
And sunspots and things don't affect ozone?
Let me just intervene here for a second. Our hour is up, and I do want to acknowledge that and have that boundary. There are important discussions to be had about global warming, and I invite you to have them if you want them. It's interesting science. By my read, it's pretty conclusive. Certainly not by everyone's. So have those conversations, but I want to say at the session today, thank you very much for being here. And tomorrow, we'll look at the biblical stuff. And maybe by the end of the week, we'll all come together.
I will be here.
Oh no! Thanks.
very much.
All right, no problem.